is forfeiture which follows the conviction of an individual, and the individual, based upon that conviction, the action proceeds against the named individual, against the person, and a determination is reached that property belonging to that person, because of that person's culpability, is to be forfeited. In a civil forfeiture case, the inquiry is not into the culpability of an individual. It is addressed to the culpability of the property and whether this particular property is used or intended to be used for future conduct. And that's the basis for the civil forfeiture. Because it's not related to conviction, because it's independent of any criminal proceeding, Article 1, Section 25 simply doesn't apply to civil forfeitures. The same would be true of Article 1, Section 16. That provision has never been applied to civil cases.
Well, I don't want to split hairs. I don't think I'm any better at guessing what the court's going to do when it's confronted with this. The kind of fiction or distinction that's made is one, I guess, some of my non-attorney colleagues say only a lawyer would appreciate, trying to distinguish, quote, whether a property can commit a crime. I mean, let's be honest, property doesn't commit a crime, an individual commits a crime, property itself. But I don't want to split hairs or continue the discussion any further. I have a real question about this proportionality issue.
Senator Springer, just to follow up on that just for a moment.
Sure.
When you have the question of proportionality, are we talking about, I mean, there are two, there are probably a lot more, but there are two things that come to mind as far as real property. What type of drugs will be manufactured on real property? One would be amphetamines, and the other would be marijuana. In the discussions, you know, during the many hours of discussions we had during the working group, nobody had any problems with amphetamines. I mean, if somebody's cooking up a batch of amphetamines, nobody cared about the forfeiture of the entire property. The question is, what if somebody was growing one marijuana plant?
Possibly people see a distinction between growing a couple marijuana plants and, you know, the meth lab. Maybe you don't see a distinction there. I think some would see a distinction in terms of the gravity of the offense.
I was merely asking a question.
Right. And, you know, whether you talk about, again, whether the entire property, well, it's obviously a point of some future discussion, I guess, which ultimately a court will resolve.
Because the theme of my question then is, are we really talking about real property, or are we talking about real property where you have marijuana being grown? I mean, is that what the fear really is?
Well, I guess part of the concern is, what is the purpose of this bill? Is it to finance law enforcement? Is it to deter criminal activity?
It is.
My sense is, when you start talking about taking all the property, the purpose shifts from deterring criminal activity, although that's part of it, subsumed within that, obviously. And then you can question whether or not the punishment, if you will, the forfeiture, is proportional to the offense. I would suggest it may not be if you're talking about confiscating an entire 40-acre or whatever it may be portion of property. And then what concerns me even greater is law enforcement using, as if the tremendous amount of resources we're devoting at the local and state level for law enforcement isn't enough, now we're going to use this device to create an incentive for our law enforcement to go and bankroll their operations looking for every piece of property they can find to forfeit because they find a couple marijuana plants growing on it. That concerns me even more.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead with your testimony?
I have nothing other than to add.
Okay, well, we'll call one or both of you back when we get into work session on this to make sure that we have your opinions on the way. Thank you. Dave Barrows and Frank Bronner. Got a piece of paper.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. Mr. Barrows and I participated in the working group during the interim, and in all of the process that brings us to this point. We support House Bill 2282 for a number of reasons. First, on the crisis that we face with 363 bank robberies, with 98% caused by drugs, our drug house problem, We've just been advised that the new Federal Drug Act will require us to report cash transactions in excess of $3,000 rather than $10,000 because of Oregon's experience. On that side, we have a great deal of reason to support this. We had four criteria as we entered the interim and dealing with this. The first was that there needed to be a statewide uniform procedure for all forfeiture, and it is that. Second, that it preempt local ordinances, and it does do that. And may I say that the language that appears on line 24 on page 1 and following into page 2, for the record, that would mean that the City of Portland ordinance dealing with DWS forfeiture of automobiles if found driving while suspended would then follow under the procedures outlined in 2282. That is the intent of the House, and it is certainly our intent in supporting this legislation. The third criteria was that it would preserve the priority of liens. It does do that throughout the bill. And fourthly, that the rights of the contract holder, mortgage holder, be that a regulated lender or an individual, would be preserved, and they are. Madam Chair, members, we wholeheartedly, enthusiastically support this bill. It is a must-pass piece of legislation for us. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Other questions? So you get your first crack at it, right, because you're going to be looking at the papers and the other folks who may or may not have an interest someplace down the line in this property probably will not.
Well, there, Madam Chair, it does provide very ample notice to all parties. And as Mr. Shepherd outlined, the notice goes to security interest holders. It goes to perfected security interest holders, those that are of record, and of course those are the only ones that have security interest. But I would say that the notice is ample, the notice is timely, no matter who they are.
Thank you. Senator Springer.
Well, for either one of our witnesses, are you folks satisfied about the representations as far as property that's leased?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, we are satisfied, and Ken Sherman, our counsel, has been a part of all of the negotiations. We and U.S. and First, who both have leasing companies, are satisfied.
How about property in which you folks may exercise responsibility as a trustee? Do you feel you have sufficient notice or opportunity to be on notice?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, our trust division has been with this bill, and they are satisfied.
Land sale contracts?
Same response.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Barrels of the Oregon League of Financial Institutions. In the interest of time, I would endorse the statements made by Mr. Bronner and indicate to the committee our strong and support of this bill and our feeling, as the Attorney General has said, this is a critically important bill, and we urge the committee's favorable consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else who hasn't had a chance to sign up? Thank you very much. Now, with the understanding that I'm going to take up House Bill 2668 because people come from Portland. This is the statute of limitations expansion and the civil opportunities to go into civil court on that basis. I will go ahead. We have everyone who has signed up is in favor of the bill. The committee has taken an action previously under the criminal statutes to extend and expand the limitations. I will. I understand that Senator Springer may or may not have another commitment, but I would be here for the record to take everybody's testimony who has signed up. So let's go ahead on House Bill 2668. It's not. It's an issue that the other committee members are not unfamiliar with and have supported in a different vein previously. So I just want to let you all know that Nancy Prevo and John Euland. Try to get you up three at a time so that we can facilitate folks better. And if you could be brief, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, while these folks are coming up,
yes.
I do have a commitment at 3:30 in the President's office, and I have supported legislation of this kind in the past and intend to support it as well this session.
All right. Thank you. And all of the written testimony that we collect will be entered into the files for people to read. And I do say that we have a heavy load, but members do read their files, at least as near as I can gather. Nancy?
My name is Nancy Pribno.
Thank you.
And I am here to testify in support of Measure 2668. I come here for myself as a victim, and I'm really here because I'm a mother with three daughters, and I hope my daughters will have rights that I didn't have. I'm here to validate that people that go through the experience that I went through, I was raped when I was 15 years old, psychologically cannot come forward until a great amount of time has passed by. 8 years went by before I was able to come forward, and at that time, I was told by the counselor who worked with me that it takes about 8 to 10 years before people can come and get the help they need. I felt grateful to have that information. I felt there was really something wrong with me, that I couldn't deal with this issue any earlier in my life. It took the commitment of marriage for me to deal with this, because I met a man who I loved and realized I couldn't have a relationship with this person because I was carrying so much of my past with me. In situations like this, it affects a great number of people. Because of my situation, I was unable to live with myself. Because I was unable to live with my family, I had to leave my family. By leaving my family, my mother wound up having a nervous breakdown and was in an institution for 2 years dealing with the loss of her child. I could go on and on. I don't think that's necessary. I think there are so many cases like mine to document the need for this sort of legislation. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. Judy?
Good afternoon. My name's Judy Snyder. I'm an attorney practicing in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We support House Bill 2668. I think it's important that we understand what 2668 does not do. It does not change the law which establishes a 5-year tolling of the statute of limitations for children who are injured in circumstances other than specifically defined child abuse. It does not change the medical malpractice statute of limitations. It only deals with child abuse as defined by the bill, and that would include intentional conduct that results in physical injury or mental injury, sexual abuse, or sexual exploitation. The current law, now this only deals with civil cases, it has nothing to do with the criminal code, but the current law tolls the statute of limitations for 5 years. However, the child must bring the action by age 19. This does away with the tolling provisions to the extent that there was a 5-year limitation, and opens the door to civil actions being filed at any time until the victim attains the age of 23. The reasons we're asking for the extension are based upon experience where countless occasions young people who were victimized as children come to the attorney's office when they're in early adulthood, having finally been able to deal with the abuse, only to find out that their right of action expired under existing law at age 19. Customarily at age 19, they're often either incapable or have been unable to deal with the abuse to even articulate it, or perhaps they're still under the economic control or under the actual control of the person who actually committed the abuse. I have prepared written testimony. I just want to call your attention to Exhibits A and B of the written testimony. Exhibit A is a letter written by Andrea Borgford, a young woman who was sexually abused by a high school teacher. She came to me when she was 20, having just then been able to talk about it and enter into therapy. Exhibit B is a poignant letter written by her mother. They testified, her mother and her father testified before the House. I'm pleased to say they're now back in Wesleyan in Connecticut for Andrea's graduation from college, and she has survived this ordeal. Attached as Exhibit C and D are letters of support from psychologists Laura Sebastian and Meg Eastman. I'm pleased to say that Dr. Sebastian is present today and is prepared to testify in support of this bill. I've also submitted in my written materials a random sample of other states which have provided for extensions of the statute of limitations. And I would not reiterate that information at this time unless the committee desires. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Judy, I have, a couple questions for you, and I don't want you to get the wrong idea that I'm suggesting an answer because I'm not. But my question is, do you feel comfortable with the way child abuse is defined in here? And the reason I ask is I've talked to the drafter of the bill, and as I understand it, this definition has been lifted from the statutes on parental rights termination. And given what little I know about the intricacies of tort law, this seems to be pretty solid departure in language, at least, from the usual tort classifications like assault and battery, for instance, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. And I'm just, is this the best way to do this, or?
I think if I were in a situation of having to plead this, I would plead it as an assault and battery defined as under the terms of this statute.
Plead it in a civil suit.
Plead it in a civil suit. The allegation would be assault and battery defined as, and I would incorporate the language of the statute to cover my basis. I appreciate the problem that you're raising because it's one that it's interesting, we've wrestled with this since the moment that the bill was being drafted, and I think every time it comes up there's a different solution that is suggested. We think, I believe that this language was chosen because of the House Committee's concern about specifically defining the nature of the conduct that they wanted to extend the statute of limitations on and not making it so broad that it might incorporate other forms of conduct which may lead to personal injuries but not be child abuse in the sense that it's defined here. I submit that, Mr. Morris, that we can work within the language of this bill, although its tone is different, as you pointed out, from the traditional tort language where we would raise standard assault and battery language.
Well, we might want to take a last opportunity to review that again if you have thoughts for improvement, we can press on to do a little better.
Yes.
If we could enlist you to work with Jack and Mr. Hendricks to just make a double sure that we have chosen the appropriate language that will work best for all people who try to bring such cases. Any other comments, Jack? Thanks, Steve.
Not be possible to improve on it. That was just a straight out question. I just don't know the answer.
Thank you. We appreciate your written testimony, and we'll follow it along. So, who do we have? Jean?
Jean Shurkoff. Madam Chair, my name is Jean Shurkoff. I work as a psychotherapist for Lutheran Family Service, and I've worked in the area of sexual abuse for about 9 years. I currently co-lead groups for adult women who've been sexually abused, and in addition to that, one-third of my practice is with children, most of whom have been sexually abused. In regard to the children, almost all of the children are not able, or their parents are not able, to pay the entire cost of therapy themselves. The state pays a lot of it because people are so severely affected by this that their ability to work is affected. And I think that should be a consideration. I'm in favor of passing the bill in the hope that it's a trend towards greater acceptance of abuse victims' plight and greater culpability of the perpetrators. Even the 5 years
in my mind, isn't enough, because a lot of the abuse victims that I see are in their late 20s or early 30s before they are able to identify this as a precursor to problems in their lives. But I think it's a good trend, and I am in support of it for that reason. I have very few cases in which women come in initially talking about having been sexually abused. Usually it's a secondary issue that comes up once they get into therapy, once they develop trust, and once they feel safe enough. And so it isn't something that's easily dealt with because of the coercion and because of the lack of support for victims in our society at this point in time. The majority of the children that I see who have gone through the judicial procedure, most of the perpetrators are back in society within a year. So I see this as a move towards supporting victims, and I think it's a positive move in that way. I also think that we have to realize that this type of crime puts victims in a position where they need long-term counseling. There isn't any quick fix in this kind of situation. And the average number of years that I see women who've been sexually abused is 3 to 5 years. That includes usually group counseling and individual counseling. So you're talking about 2 hours of group counseling per week, 1 hour of individual counseling per week, sometimes 2 hours of individual counseling per week. And it's very costly. And it seems that the perpetrators should have to bear the brunt of some of that cost, because these are usually people who are trying to make ends meet, can't because of this crime, and then incur greater debt themselves in trying to make themselves healthier. So I think that's another support of this bill. Yes.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your coming, taking the time to do that. Eleanor Dominguez and Laura Sebastian. And I don't, is Mark Williams here?
Another
Mark Williams. It's different than the Mark Williams that I know.
Three of us.
There
Eleanor.
Yeah. My name's Eleanor Dominguez. I was severely sexually abused by my father as a child for 7 years, and he has over 250 known victims, two of which were my children. My father was also the pastor of a large congregation, and some of those victims were from that church and are still under the age of 23. I did not remember any of my own abuse until 2.5 years ago, when one victim and my children began talking. I was 26. I understand it is very common for victims to suppress their abuse until their adult years, as in my case. Although the bill does not affect my own abuse history specifically, it is an example as to the time it takes to realize the damage it has on a person's life. I have been in counseling for over 2 years, and my children have been in counseling for over a year. After a year and a half of my own counseling, I was overwhelmed by the fact that my abuse was severely affecting me financially and emotionally. Because of the position of control my father had over me as a parent, and over other children and families as a pastor, the safety to talk or even remember was and is impossible. This bill gives a child more time to get out on their own, a chance to get some kind of help and compensation for their suffering, to get their lives to some kind of normality. I have had to quit my job as an office manager for a CPA firm so I could handle the stress that is in my life because of the abuse. As of 7 months ago, I went on welfare so I could continue to pay for my children's and my own therapy. I go a total of 10 hours a week between my children, my husband and I, and myself. The state is paying. The person who should be paying is out of my reach because of the law. It may not help me, but it would give hundreds of other victims a chance for help from the person responsible.
So is this, there have been no resolution or cases brought under any circumstances at the moment?
Against my father?
Yes.
Yes, he's okay. Serving a 60-year sentence in the state penitentiary right now for three of the victims.
Madam Chair, my name is Laura Sebastian. I'm a psychologist in private practice in Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Psychological Association and myself as a private practitioner. My reason for your support of this bill is based on my years of evaluation of treatment of children and families and adults who have been sexually abused, and based on my court testimony, especially in evaluations of children who come into the custody of Children's Services Division as a result of multiple kinds of abuse. Some of the other factors that other testimony hasn't talked about are the psychological factors that children are taught to obey their elders, and when they do so by participating in sexual abuse, the resulting confusion often causes them to withdraw socially and or act out sexually later on. It's very common for victims not to report abuse until considerably after the incident. The reason for this are threats from the perpetrator, developmental level of the victim, guilt, and self-blame. When they do report, it's frustrating to tell them that there is nothing that can be legally done to stop the perpetrator because of the statute of limitations. Being sexually abused gives a victim a profound sense of powerlessness. Being able to have a perpetrator face the legal consequences as a result of their acts creates in the victim a sense of hopelessness. Sexual abuse is a crime with a victim and a perpetrator. Both of these people need help. And this bill will provide a way for victims to relieve the frustration they feel when they finally reveal the secret, only to find out there's nothing that can be legally done. If there's other information that you'd like, I'd be glad to provide it through the Psychological Association or through other members. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mark.
Thank you. Mark Williams. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland with the firm of McMenamin & Associates. A number of the people that are here to testify today or here just to witness are clients of ours or people we've been come in contact with through our practice. It's a practice which focuses on clergy malpractice and is a practice which brings us into contact with a lot of people that we see that we can't help, that have concerns and problems, and a portion of those clients that we can't help fall into this category. They're over the age of 23 or over the age of 19. Under the age of 23, have been sexually abused as children, and there is no recourse for them because the statute of limitations has already passed. Cases such as Eleanor's, this case wouldn't necessarily go back and help her either, but does help people in her situation who come to an attorney, some attorney in time. Concern we have about the cost and the fairness of this, in Eleanor's situation, for instance, the perpetrator is in prison. Even if the statute of limitations helps her, it may likely result in the judgment against someone who's in prison and who will never have a capacity to help her out financially. The cost is still going to be borne by the state. In cases such as Eleanor's, other people who are abused by people who are put in positions of authority by institutions or organizations, be that the Boy Scouts of America or a particular church or the state of Oregon, a school district, whoever it is that puts that person in the power in the position of authority, their sexual abuse conduct is outside the scope of the job description. No one hires them to sexually abuse children. And case law is very clear that those people are not going to be liable on that basis. The case law, however, is also supportive of a cause of action based on negligent supervision by an institution of its employees, negligence in hiring, in looking at the record of an individual. If, for instance, a pastor is diagnosed as a pedophile or as having problems with sexually abusive behavior somewhere in his education or training, or is put into a position in a church and a problem arises, report is made to the church authorities, the church authorities take action, and if the action is inappropriate and results in this pastor being put in another church where he can go ahead and sexually abuse more victims, then we believe that the liability of the institution for making those kinds of decisions should be something we can pursue. And the language in this case, we arguably would cover that kind of a case, although it's only arguably. It is not crystal clear on the face of this language. And we'd rather have half a loaf than none. We'd rather that this statute passed as it is written than have no statute passed. But if we could have a whole loaf, we would choose to have language which would make an action based on child abuse, but not only based on the actual act of child abuse, but on conduct which allows or permits or encourages child abuse. Now, that's a broadening of this, of the language that you see before you, but I think that it's fairly within the scope of this provision and really better addresses the concerns you've heard raised today, the concerns that